I hope you have enjoyed this look in Genesis chapter 1. This is actually our fifth class, if I've counted them right, our fifth class talking about God's wonderful creation. And reality is we could keep going, but I think we need to switch over to something else. But there is so much in this one chapter that perhaps we haven't seen all of this before, but it is truly an amazing chapter about an amazing creation of God as he brought this into reality. And we have started this study just talking about those 6 days of creation. And, you know, as I thought about these days of creation, even today, I wonder when was the first time you heard about the 6 days of creation? When did you first learn the days of creation? For some of you, it may have been just a few weeks ago or a couple of years ago. Some of you, you learned days of creation decades ago. And yet, think about how foundational this is. And think about, maybe I've known this for years or decades. But think about the fact that this is the creation of God when there was no light. And yet, on day one, God creates light when there was none. On day two, God takes that water and he creates the firmament, separating that water, the waters above and the waters below. As he does that on day two, we get to day three and all of the dry land starts to appear and all of the beautiful growth of God's creation, the trees and the flowers, all of this beautiful creation comes into reality. On day four, God creates the sun, the moon, and the stars. And imagine what that would have been like to see that for the very first time. On day five, we know that he created the fish and the fowl, because five and fish and fowl all start with an F, and that's easy for us to remember. But imagine being there as you see that life start to swim and start to fly in the air. On day six, he creates the creeping things. He creates those animals that would live upon the earth, some of those animals that we know and love, some of those animals that we know and don't so much love, but we are thankful to look around and to see God's creation and to know there on that sixth day that he created man, and he gave man the task of naming all of the animals that he had created. And when it came time for God to look down at man and to realize that while there were companions for his other creatures, he said it was not good for man to be alone. And so God created the woman for the man and brought her to the man and gave her away in marriage to Adam and created marriage there on day six. And it was on that occasion when God said that man's to leave his father and mother and to be joined to his wife, and they're to cleave to each other. They're to be super glued to each other, and they become one flesh with one another. And so as we look at that and we just think about how wonderful the creation of God is. And so we spent the last 4 weeks, and this is week number five, looking at the emphasis that is made in this chapter and what we can learn about God's creation. We noticed back in
in Genesis chapter 1 that the emphasis in this chapter is upon God. That's the emphasis throughout this chapter. Is upon God. He's mentioned 32 times in 31 verses as you go through this chapter, and that's the main focus that we are introduced to this, to our God, and we are introduced to exactly who He is. We learn about the power of God when the Bible says that God created all things and He made all things. And it's mentioned 11 times in this chapter that God created or God made all things. We also see in this book that in this chapter that he says over and over that God said, God said, God said. We have 11 times that God said, God said, God said. It was the power of God that brought everything into creation. We saw that God looked down, and every time he had completed a day of creation, he saw that it was good. And then at the end of the sixth day, in the very last verse, it says that it was very good. And so it was not just a half job that God had done. Everything that God had made was good. And I want you to imagine that the all-powerful God could have done anything that he wanted on these days of creation. And the things that he did were absolutely perfect and good in every way. There's the emphasis in this chapter that God created all things in 6 days. I want you to think about, now, obviously, God could have created everything in 6 seconds. He could have created everything in 6 minutes. He could have created it at any time frame that he wanted to, and yet the time frame that he chose was 6 literal 24-hour days. And as he creates these, creates everything, it comes to the end of the day, and it says the evening and the morning were the first day, the second day, the third day. And we spent some time looking at how the Bible emphasizes these were not long expanses of time, but in 6 days he made everything. We saw as we've gone through this chapter that God created everything according to its kind. 11 times in this chapter we read that expression, even about man being made according to, God said, let us make man according to his image. And so we see that as he makes everything, that everything has the ability to produce according to its kind. And so the emphasis here is that when you have a little buffalo, that, well, what is a grown-up buffalo going to have? That grown-up buffalo is going to have another buffalo because everything makes according to its kind. And what's a rose going to have? And what's a duck going to have? Everything God made was to make according to its kind. There is no room in creation. There's no room for evolution, for life to come from non-life. That's not the way that it works. That all of a sudden some single cell organism is going to create some multi-cell, billions of cells organism is very complex. That's not the way that it works. And so as you think about the complexity of the creation of God and the magnificence of the creation of God, I want us to stand in awe of our God, that he made all things and he made them perfectly in every way. Tonight, I just want us to look at one major point, and then we're going to have one point of application here at the end of this tonight. But I want you to think about the fact that when we look around at the creation, we can see God. We can see the power of God. We can know that God exists simply by the creation that is around us. Now, we see this in Genesis chapter 1. But we see this throughout the rest of the Bible, that that just by looking at God's creation, that that we can know that there is a God and that our God is alive. Not just that there is a God, but we learn about the very nature of this God by looking at his creation. Tonight, I want to talk about two different laws of science. Last week, we talked about the law of biogenesis. But tonight I want us to talk about two other laws that are significant and are extremely important for us to understand when it comes to this matter of creation. First, I want us to talk about the law of cause and effect. And this is not some law that creationists have come up with. This is not some law that that Christians have come up with. This is a law that is accepted in the science community called the law of cause and effect. And it's not difficult to understand. The very name gives it away, and it indicates the law of cause and effect teaches that every material effect, everything that you see, everything that you can touch, everything that is around us is a material effect. every material effect must have an adequate cause, an adequate cause, not just a cause, but an adequate cause that existed before the effect came into existence. Now, I know that's a lot of words to think about and maybe a little complex to put together, but the law of cause and effect says that if there's something that is here, that's an effect, it had to have a cause. And the cause had to be adequate enough in order to bring that effect into reality. And obviously, it had to exist before the effect. It wouldn't make sense for it to come after the effect. So somebody says, well, what does that mean? What is that all about? Why is that important for us to understand? Well, I know some of you have told me just in the recent months, but within the last year, I know some of you have been up to Washington, D.C., and have visited many of the great historic sites up in Washington, D.C. And while you were there, I've heard from a number of you that you traveled out to Mount Vernon and saw the place where George Washington grew up and saw George Washington's house. And it's quite a magnificent structure. I want you think about the fact that this was a house that Washington's father began to build when Washington was just a child in the 1730s. And then as Washington became an adult and he was able to have that as his own home in the 1750s, he started to add on to it. And even in the 1770s, he was continue to add the various wings onto it. So here's a magnificent, beautiful structure that some of you have walked through and you have enjoyed seeing the historical nature of this. Now, I want you to imagine that when your tour guide brings you outside of that home, after you have toured all of the beauty of that home, your tour guide comes out and your tour guide notices a mound of carpenter ants that is over next to this beautiful structure, that there is a mound of carpenter ants. Well, you know, when I think of carpenter ants, I know I'm wrong about this, but when I hear the word carpenter, I think about creatures that can build and have the ability to create great things. At least that's what a carpenter is to me. I know that's not what a carpenter ant is, but let's just suppose that your tour guide walks out and he sees a mound of carpenter ants there and he says, I want you to see, do you see those carpenter ants over there? Well, they are the ones who built this house back in the 1750s. What would you think of your tour guide? What would you think of your tour guide who points to a mound of carpenter ants that can't be but a few days or maybe a couple weeks at the most old, and he says, that mound of carpenter ants over there built this house back in the 1730s. What would you think? You would absolutely know without a shadow of a doubt that that guy was nuts. Why? Because of the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect says every material effect, including Mount Vernon, including that house, must have an adequate cause. Could those carpenter ants be an adequate cause that brought about that building? No, of course not. Did they exist before that building? No, so it wouldn't work. But you think, well, that's kind of silly. Well, magnify that and think about the existence of our universe. We have a material effect in which we live. We live in a vast universe, a universe that is a mystery in many ways to the smartest people on the face of this earth, who are still trying to understand, still trying to see the ends of this universe and to grasp the magnitude of it. And so I want you to think about somebody coming to you and saying to you about this universe that has 100 billion galaxies in it. We live in one of those galaxies, the Milky Way galaxy. There are 100 billion galaxies inside of our universe, and each of those galaxies has about 100 billion stars in it. And as best as can be figured, this universe is over 100 billion light years wide or long. And I want you to imagine that somebody comes to you with this massive, beautiful, exquisite universe in which we live, and they tell you that a tiny ball of matter that is smaller than the period that is printed out on a piece of paper from your printer, smaller than a period that's in a book that you've been reading, smaller than the period on the page of that paper, that period was small enough there, and it exploded, that it banged, that little period banged big enough to create this massive, vast universe. What would you think of a person who said that to you? Would that make sense? I want you to think about the law of cause and effect. We live inside of a material effect called this universe. Is the Big Bang of something smaller than a period on a printed page in your book, is that an adequate cause? Honestly, is that an adequate cause for what we see? There's no way it could bang big enough to create everything that we see here, especially that which was non-living to create that which is living. There must have been, think about this, the universe in which we live tells us there must have been an original cause that was substantial enough to bring about the effect that is here. That is just pure common sense. And to be told otherwise makes no sense. That's law number one that I want us to think about tonight. Law number two that I want us to consider tonight is the law of rationality. Now, this is very similar to the law of cause and effect, but the law of rationality teaches us that as we observe these things around us, that one must, look at this word only, one must only draw and accept conclusions that are warranted by clear evidence. You are a rational creature. You have a brain in your head. And the law of rationality says that you should only, you not just should, you must only draw and accept conclusions that are warranted by the clear evidence that is there. Now, what does that mean? I want us to take this and just consider this in one facet of understanding tonight, and that is in the matter of design. I want you to think about, is there any evidence of design around us today? And if there is design, then the conclusion that is demanded is that if there is design, there must be a designer. And somebody says, oh, well, there go those creationists again, talking about design, must be a designer, law of rationality. Okay, well, let's not talk about the universe for a minute. Let's not talk about the earth for a minute. I want you, and you don't have to do this, but just in your imagination, do this. I want you to imagine, in your imagination, go out to your driveway, to your car, and I want you to pop the hood on your car, and I want you to look underneath the hood of your car, and I want you to tell me, as you look underneath the hood of your car, that just happened by accident. I want you to tell me that everything you see under the hood of your car, that all just happened by accident in somebody's auto parts store. There was just an explosion, and it created this engine that works with your air conditioner and everything else. And I looked at this picture today, and it even looks like there's a cup holder on top of the engine there. But I want you to imagine that somebody tells you this just happened by accident. What would you think of that person that told you this just happened by an accidental explosion? That, use your rational thinking brain and understand that's not the way it works. This engine teaches there is great design, more design here than we used to see under the hoods of our old cars back as decades ago. There's an exquisite design here. What does that demand? It demands a designer. When you go to the store, well, you, today, You have to imagine going to the store because you're not allowed to go to the store these days. But imagine you go to the store. Have you ever been in Sam's or in Costco? I guess they're still open and Walmart's still open. But you go in the store and Sam's and Costco, they got these big stacks of shirts there. And I want you to imagine somebody tells you that those shirts just happened by accident. There was an explosion in a cloth store, and that explosion created these shirts that are perfectly fitted and measured with all of the buttons and the buttonholes that line up. And after the explosion, these shirts not only came into existence, but they were perfectly folded and laid down in a perfect stack like this. What would you think of a person that told you that that happened by accident? What would you think of that? That doesn't make any sense. You know that if you see a shirt and if you see a nice stack of shirts, that there's been somebody working really hard at Costco or Sam's to make those stacks as neat as there are. Some of you at home have one of those magic drawers, and you know what I'm talking about. You go over to your magic drawer, and inside your magic drawer, all of a sudden, there's clean laundry in there that wasn't there the day before. Where'd that come from? That didn't happen by accident. Somebody's been doing your laundry and putting it inside. You understand that laundry doesn't happen by accident. There's got to be somebody that's behind all of that. I put this picture in here for some of our young people. I want you to imagine that under the Christmas tree this year, there is a Millennium Falcon Lego set, that this particular one has 7,541 pieces. 7,541 pieces are in a box for this Lego set. And I want you to imagine that somebody says, if you just get the right explosion, all of them will come together in this beautiful, well-done piece. What would you think of that person? Have you ever been to South Dakota? Have you ever been to Mount Rushmore? Have you ever looked at the Black Mountains there, and you look at one mountain, and then you look at Mount Rushmore, and you think, oh, that just happened by accident. There was just an explosion up there, and all of a sudden is the perfect images of four presidents. No, of course not. What about an F-15? You look at an F-15, well, that just happened by accident. You get the point, don't you? You get the point nice and clear that as you start looking through these things and understanding the very nature of what we have in the things that man has created around us, we know that these things didn't happen by accident. And design, whether it be a jet or Mount Rushmore or a Lego set or a stack of shirts, demands that there was a designer, somebody behind that. Well, why is that not the case when it comes to the universe that is millions, maybe billions of times more complex than any physical material thing that you will see today? What about the earth on which we live that is millions or billions of times more complex than any engine that you're going to see underneath your hood, any stack of shirts you're going to find inside your closet? Those didn't happen by accident. Neither does the earth that we live on. What about the body in which you are living? What about the exquisite and intricate nature of every system that makes up your body? That did not happen by accident. Why? Because the law of rationality says one must only draw and accept conclusions that are warranted by clear evidence. Is there clear evidence in the design of our bodies? Is there clear evidence in our earth and in our universe? So much so that design demands a designer. And to argue against that is to argue irrationally and against the evidence that is there. I want to share one more picture with you. Some of those pictures before, you may have readily recognized what they were. Maybe you will not recognize what this is. But I want you to take a look at this picture, and I want you to try to guess what this picture is for a moment. And some of you probably have seen this, and you do know what it is, but I would guess the majority of us have no clue what we're looking at on the screen right now. And it's not the best quality picture, but I had to blow it up a little bit so that you could see it. But I want to share with you tonight that what you are looking at here, first of all, would you say that what you're looking at here happened by accident? Would you say that any part of what you're looking at here happened by accident? Or does it look like somebody had to take some time to put this together? I want to share with you tonight that what you are looking at on your screen tonight is a stomach. That's right. What you are looking at on your screen tonight is a stomach. An artificial stomach. that was created and built by British scientists at the Institute of Food Research back in 2006. You are looking at a stomach. There is a man by the name of Dr. Martin Wickman who was called, in all of the reports that I've read about this, he was called the chief designer. Isn't that an interesting word? He was called the chief designer. What does that say? This artificial stomach did not happen by accident. So what does this artificial stomach do? This artificial stomach stimulates, and this is their words. These are the reports that came out back in 2006 about this artificial stomach. This artificial stomach stimulates or mimics human digestion. Stimulates or mimics human digestion, both the physical and the chemical parts, including the stomach contractions that break up the food and then move it along the digestive tract. I want you to think about that. They created a machine that would try to do what the stomach does. It's constructed from sophisticated plastics and metals that are able to withstand the corrosive acids and enzymes found in your gut. Is your stomach made of plastics and metals? No. But the only thing they could use were plastics and metals to stand up against the acids and enzymes that are in your digestive tract. Well, how does your stomach deal with those kinds of things? This particular thing is a two-part model. You see that. The top part has the funnel where you pour the food and the stomach acids and the digestive enzymes. You pour that in and mix it up in the top. And then you open it up and it goes down in, and there's a metal tube that starts to crunch up the pieces of food, although I read that the most extensive meal this stomach has ever had is vegetable soup. Big deal. But the most extensive meal it's ever had was vegetable soup. But it's got a metal tube that crunches up the food so that it could be absorbed, if there was one, by a human body. And guess what's controlling this whole thing? Computer software. They had to write computer software that would set the parameters for this stomach to function, that would control how long the food would be in a particular part of the stomach, that would predict the hormone responses at various stages along the way, that would release at the right times and in the right places the secretions into the process, that would adjust whether it was an infant stomach or an adult stomach. It had to have a computer software to figure all of that out. And here you're looking at something, I don't know if it's on the screen here, maybe it's on the next slide, maybe I forgot to put it on here, that the size of this thing is about the size, there it is, two-part model, slightly larger than a desktop computer. Can you imagine if you had to carry around a desktop computer in your gut all day? But that's the size of this stomach that they made. But the capacity of this stomach is only half the size of an actual stomach. They had to build this monstrosity of a thing, but it can only hold half of what a normal stomach can hold. And it cost the British government $1,800,000 to build. Are you getting a little drift of what we're talking about here? The chief designer created something that you're looking at on the screen here, and they would kick you if you told them it happened by accident. That wouldn't be acceptable. And yet, what about this stomach? What about this body? We're supposed to believe this, that is even more intricate, even more complex, millions of times more complex than that artificial stomach. We're supposed to believe this happened by accident. So the chief designer, the guy who has the patent on this thing and designed this thing, listen to what he says. Dr. Wickman said, our knowledge of what actually happens in the gut is still, he says, what we know about what happens in the stomach is still very rudimentary. What does that mean? We still don't have much of a clue about how the stomach works. And so we're hoping this model can help fill in some of the blanks. So the model they built, they are hoping can give them some insight into something that is still very rudimentary in their knowledge of how it works. What does that tell you about the complexity of your human stomach? There was another man, he didn't have any part in building this, but he is the head of metabolic medicine at Imperial College. He talked about this particular experiment, Dr. Stephen Bloom, and listen to what he says. The stomach is an extraordinarily complex organ. No kidding. He's not a creationist, but what is he stating? The obvious. The stomach is an extraordinarily complex organ. So you cannot create a model that will undertake all of these functions. Here's a man who's not trying to say that the stomach in humans are created, but he is admitting the complexity of it, and he is admitting that no human could create anything that would come close to the human stomach and do all that. What are you saying? Our human stomach is beyond human explanation. All of this came to light to me in a recent article that Kyle Butt published with Apologetics Press. And here is one of the conclusions that Kyle Butt published in that article recently on the Apologetics Press website. He said, one very important point needs to be noted about this artificial stomach. It is complex, expensive, took hundreds or thousands of hours to design and build, but it still cannot accomplish all the processes of a real human stomach. Yet, we are to believe that the human stomach evolved over millions of years by random chance processes with no intelligent agent responsible for any of its construction. I want you to let that sink in, and we saw a picture of a man-made stomach, and nobody would say that happened by accident. What about the human stomach? Where did it come from? The only sensible, the law of rationality, the only rational conclusion based upon the clear evidence is that just like the artificial stomach, your human stomach was designed. It was created by a creator who is much wiser and more powerful than any human being ever imagined to be. Aren't you glad that God made the evidence, God made the evidence for his creation so explicitly clear for us to see all around us? Psalm 139, verse 14 says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. I know we're a little bit over time here, but I want to share with you some verses that you need to have written on your heart. Because what we have looked at tonight are scientific laws, the law of cause and effect, the law of rationality. But these are taught in the Bible. I want you to think about what the Bible says. In Psalm 19 and verse 1, New American Standard says, the heavens are telling of the glory of God. The heavens are talking to us. They're telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring, it's preaching the work of his hands. You cannot look at the creation of God and not hear the creation of God talking to you and saying, there is a God who exists. Hebrews 3 and verse 4 says, every house is built by someone. Yeah, no kidding. Even Mount Vernon, you would never say that it was built by carpenter ants. You would never say it happened by accident. Every house is built by someone. Well, who built all things? That has to be God. In Romans 1 and verse 20, what a great verse this is. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, you can't see them, but his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Well, how can I clearly see something that is invisible? They are understood by the things that are made. What can I understand about God by looking at what has been made? Two things, his eternal power. I can understand the eternal power of God, and the New King James has the word Godhead. Other translations have the expression divine nature. I can understand God's eternal power, and I can understand God's divine nature by doing what? By being a scientist? No. By looking around, by opening my eyes and my ears and my senses to everything that is around me, to the point that God says, they are without excuse who do not accept the power and the divine nature of God. I wish we had time to look at Psalm 8. Read this psalm tonight. It's a short psalm. It's a short psalm, but it says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. And it talks about the beauty of God's creation. It says, what is man that God is mindful of us? That in the magnificence of God, why would he even think about us? In Isaiah 6 and verse 3, Isaiah got to peer into the throne room of God, and he heard those creatures around the throne of God saying, holy, holy, holy. We focus on that a lot, is the Lord of hosts. But look at what the end of verse 3 says. The whole earth is full of his glory. You look around today, and the whole earth of God is screaming. Look back up on the screen in Psalm 19 and verse 1. The heavens are talking to us about the glory of God. Everything that we see in God's creation is telling us about the existence and the power of the one true God. So much so that we are without excuse if we fail to accept that He is real and that He is not just a God, He is the God of the Bible. What should be our response? We're not going to take time to develop these, but just three things. We have spent 5 weeks talking about God's wonderful creation. How should we respond to His wonderful creation? Number one, stand in awe of God, of His power, of His creation, of His magnificence. Number two, don't just stand in awe of Him, worship Him. Fall down before Him. Don't just stand in awe of Him, tell Him how awesome He is, and worship and praise His name. Number three, we need to tell others about our God. If you read Psalm 8 tonight, you might read Psalm 96 too. It's not very long either. But Psalm 96 brings these points out for us. How should we respond to the creation of God? Stand in awe of Him, worship Him, and tell others about Him. I hope that you have enjoyed this study about the creation of God. It ought to change us. It ought to draw us closer to Him. It ought to help us to long to be pleasing to Him, the God who made us in His image. Thanks be to God that when we pick up our Bibles, He starts off with a bang. The evolutionists think they have a big bang. Genesis chapter 1 is God's big bang right at the very beginning. Not that I'm not saying He used the big bang. Some people teach that. I'm not saying that at all. But He starts off with a bang. He doesn't wait to get halfway through the book to impress you. He impresses you right on the first page. Thanks be to God for His wonderful creation.